So, I shall begin with a few words about this text, Bhagavad Gita. This Bhagavad Gita is considered to be the most important and the most celebrated religious and spiritual document of Hindu religion and Vedanta tradition. And in a way, it is safe to say it is the oldest among the world religious classics that are available today. It contains 700 verses divided into 18 chapters. Though it is somewhat small in size, just about 700 verses, but it is a part of a much bigger classical work in Sanskrit known as Mahabharata, which is more than 100,000 verses. This contains more than 100,000 verses. Plus, if you include some other larger versions, it may come close to 140,000 verses. So arguably, it is the largest, the most voluminous religious and literary classic known to mankind. It is placed somewhere 1800 BC, the present version of Mahabharata, but it deals with an event which is supposed to have taken place in the in around 3200 BC. That's the estimate. This is Mahabharata war. So that's about Gita. So I mentioned that Gita is the most prominent Hindu Vedantic religious text. Now, how it came to be known in the United States, that's what I'm going to deal with now, today. Now, America's greatest mystic, Emerson, was the first American intellectual who spoke about Gita and was inspired by this text. It doesn't deal with the religious ideas of a single group or a single religious tradition. That's one uniqueness about it. It deals with the spiritual aspirations of the human being. So if you read the Gita, you don't find that Gita is dealing with Hinduism or Hindu faith system or any particular religious doctrine. It deals with the basic higher spiritual aspirations of an average, evolved, educated, refined human being. That's why it caught the attention of a great American mystic like Emerson. Emerson got a copy of the Bhagavad Gita translated into English by an English clerk who was employed by East India Company. His name was Charles Wilkins. He was actually employed as a clerk by the East India Company, which had already established itself in Bengal province of India with the, by around 1780. They already established in the Bengal province of India. So Calcutta was the capital. So the first Governor General of English East India Company in Bengal was Sir Warren Hastings. He was a British aristocrat. Under his employment, there was this gentleman. His name was Charles Wilkins. So Charles Wilkins was asked by some of his friends to translate Gita into English. And it was published by British East India Company with an introduction in English by Sir Warren Hastings. And that book came to the hands of Emerson. And later Thoreau, Whitman, and many of the great intellectuals of America's East Coast, including many of the later transcendentalists like Thoreau and Whitman, many of the leaders of the Christian Science movement, including Mary Baker. So it had become very popular by the time Vivekananda, the founder of Vedanta Society, came to this country. Now, what I want to talk to you about something else. In his introduction, this English gentleman, who had no reason to admire anything belonging to Hindu tradition or Hinduism, makes a very interesting statement, which actually vindicates the fact that in this 2018 we are discussing Bhagavad Gita in San Francisco. I shall read out his statement. He says, the writers of the Indian philosophical systems, the writers of Indian philosophies, will survive the British dominion in India after the British dominion in India have long ceased to exist. There are some words missing, the document is not clear. But these are quotations from his own document. The writers of the Indian philosophies will survive when the British dominion in India shall long have ceased to exist, and when the sources which it yielded of wealth and power and knowledge are lost to remembrance. What he says is, Bhagavad Gita will survive even long after the British Empire has ceased to exist. That is a statement. What it means is, a most unlikely person like Sir Warren Hastings came to know of the greatness of Bhagavad Gita. So as I mentioned earlier, Gita doesn't deal with the religious ideas of a single religious tradition exclusively. When you read it, you find Lord Krishna, the teacher of the Bhagavad Gita, is answering some of your own questions, no matter what religion you are born into. Or even if you do not believe in God or religion, doesn't matter. Lord Krishna is talking about some of the higher spiritual aspirations of any refined, cultured human being who wants to live a happy, contented, and meaningful spiritual life. When at one point, at the flash of a moment, we may realize that with all the money, wealth, status, job, all this, well, they are needed. Gita does not ask you to reject or renounce everything and go to a forest. It doesn't say that. What it tells you is, in order to be able to enjoy all these, you need a higher ideal to look forward to. So once you have fixed your mind on a higher ideal, then our everyday activities, our secular activities, our everyday responsibilities and duties, whether you're working in a university or an office or a hospital, wherever it is, all these duties and responsibilities will appear to be more meaningful. They acquire a new meaning, a new relevance. So that's what Bhagavad Gita is dealing with, the basic higher spiritual aspirations of human beings. So you may have heard about yoga. I'm not talking about yoga postures, physical exercises taught in yoga studios. But yoga has got a higher meaning. Yoga here means linking ourselves to some higher ideal. That's what yoga actually means. Yoga, linking, connecting our life with some higher ideal, so that all our life, all our activities will acquire a new meaning. So you find four yogas mentioned in this text: Karma Yoga, Raja Yoga, Bhakti Yoga and Jnana Yoga. I am not going to deal with these technical details. So I shall begin with one of the most relevant and important, useful topics discussed in the Gita, useful for our times: Karma Yoga. You know what Lord Krishna is talking about. In fact, one of the revolutionary contributions of the teacher of Bhagavad Gita is he asks us, he teaches us to look upon our everyday activities from a new perspective, from a new angle, not giving up work. In fact, he says an ideal karma yogi, somebody who practices karma as yoga. I shall try to explain what karma yoga in actual life means. So a person who is practicing karma yoga, he may be a student, a teacher, he may be a doctor, he may be an engineer, he may belong to any profession. Because all of us do work. We cannot run away from work. Even when you are sitting in an easy chair, still we are working in our mind. So, inaction, both psychological and physical inaction together, is an impossibility. No one can keep quiet. Even when physically we are inactive, our mind will be always hyperactive, thinking, ideas coming and going. Lord Krishna says, normally, there are different ways of doing work. Perfectionism, efficiency, professionalism, result orientation, a strong sense of duty consciousness, Kantian concept of, you know, perfectionism. This is what we normally understand as efficiency or perfection in work. You should do with full attention, full concentration, full focus, so that you succeed. If you are a businessman, you should make a lot of money. If you are a student, you should get highest grade, so you get the highest job. Or if you are a politician, then you should be successful in mobilizing supporters and so on. Whatever may be our profession or our job, we should pay full attention, full focus and succeed. This is what we normally understand by success in work and success in life in a broader sense. Lord Krishna says, this is okay. He admits that this is perfectly okay. Now, suppose a person has worked very hard, is a businessman or industrialist or any professional, has made billions of dollars, very successful, very happy, but he has no inner contentment. He has to take pills every day to get 2 hours of sleep, very often, and a lot of stress, anxiety, tension, and still succeeding in business or industry or profession, making more and more money. Is that really success? So it is success from an objective point of view. Your credit card, your balance sheet, your bank account statements will show that you are successful. But then in our inner life, tension, anxiety, anguish, is that a very happy state of mind? No. Because many of these people who are extremely successful have to run away from themselves, have to flee from their own mind and take refuge in alcohol and drugs. So how to succeed, how to make life more meaningful? So Lord Krishna says, link this perfectionist attitude towards work to some higher ideal, which goes beyond material success. So he brings in a very revolutionary, psychologically very useful tool, is called detachment. Detachment doesn't mean indifference. It means not being enslaved by an obsessive desire for money, success, and material wants. That's all. It means freedom from internal psychological enslavement. So how can we work hard, succeed in life, and still remain free from this anxiety, this tension, this anguish? If we can do that, then it is a very wonderful thing. On the one hand, you get all the benefits of efficiency in action and none of its drawbacks. So very often the most successful people are also the most depressed. Many of the countries, not America, many of the European countries and some Asian countries also, who attain very high level of success, material prosperity, have also the highest degree of suicides, the highest percentage of patients suffering from depression. Countries like Japan, Sweden are examples, smaller countries comparatively, but highly successful in many of these areas. So Krishna tells you, success, efficiency, professionalism are wonderful. In fact, Lord Krishna, the teacher of the Gita, insists that you need to pay your full attention to what you are doing. But at the same time, while doing your work with all efficiency, looking for success, you should also remember all these benefits, all these comforts, all these advantages of success will disappear one day. It's not that, remember, Gita is not giving before you, presenting before you a negative picture of life. No. Anyone who says, no, I don't want to hear anything negative, actually, it is a sign of internal weakness. We should be able to listen to the negative also, not to be frightened or scared, but to get a balanced view, a balanced assessment of life as a whole. So Lord Krishna is a teacher of the Bhagavad Gita, tells you that do your work and attain the highest degree of proficiency, efficiency, success. But remember, keep in your mind this fact that all these advantages, comforts, the benefits of success are impermanent. You will not take them with you when you leave this world. It doesn't mean that you should be negative or you should be pessimistic, not at all. This higher wisdom Lord Krishna wants to put before you. So I can quote one verse, Saktaha Karmanya Vidvamso Yatha Kurvanti Bharata Kuryan Vidvan Tatha Asaktaha Chigishu Loka Sangraham. This is one interesting verse which puts forward this idea. Lord Krishna says, there are two types of people in the world. Very successful, very rich, very beneficial, but always anxious, always worried, always restless. Sometimes trying to run away from their own mental agonies, taking refuge in drugs and drinks and so on. Have all external benefits, external requirements for happiness, but happiness is only outward. There is no inner contentment. That's because they're sakta, means they are so much obsessed, psychologically so much obsessed with the benefits of material life. So for them, there is success, they are efficient, lot of enthusiasm, but there is no inner contentment, there is no sense of inner fulfillment. They are still looking for something higher, always a state of a perpetual state of discontentment. This is the picture of a normal human being who is enslaved, psychologically enslaved, by their own desires. Now Lord Krishna gives another picture. On the other side, there is a different type of person. Maybe his brother or whoever may be. Who is equally ambitious, equally hardworking, equally efficient, but he understands, well, I am working hard. I may get a very high grade. I may get a wonderful job. Or I have already got a wonderful, I have a big bank balance. But I will not carry that bank balance with me when I leave this world. You should not, and it will never make you pessimistic. But it will give you a new perspective towards success. Actually, that will help you to really succeed. The real success is when you understand the limitation of material success. It's called karma yoga. That means karma means action. And when this action, activity, profession, duties are linked to a higher ideal, the higher ideal is spiritual fulfillment. What does spiritual fulfillment really means? Becomes obvious in this class. So Gita is actually a dialogue between two men of action. One is Arjuna, the other way is Lord Krishna. Lord Krishna in Hindu tradition is considered to be an incarnation of God. So when he teaches Karma Yoga, there are many wonderful things that he says. When you actually try to do your work with the full understanding, well, I have to do my duty, that is my duty, I have to do it to the best of my ability, I should not fail. But even in the midst of that, if you can remember, well, all the benefits of my work are necessary, but there is something higher I should look for in order to get spiritual contentment. Then it becomes karma yoga. I shall try to explain how Lord Krishna puts forward this idea in the context of his teacher. You can find evolution of human mind and evolution of the concept of duty in this text. Now, the text begins with a few statements about some of the problems faced by the student, Arjuna. Arjuna was facing a big problem. The problem was this. His duty, he was a soldier by profession. Just as you are a farmer by profession, a doctor by profession, lawyer by profession, he was a soldier by profession. So his duty was to save, to help the poor and the weak from problems and people with problems. You know. That was his job. So one day, suddenly, he became depressed. So he was actually a very active person, very efficient person. But because he had a problem to face, he wanted to give a justification for not doing his duty. Because some of the people with whom he was supposed to fight in order to save poor men, poor women, poor children, weak people, happened to be some of his own distant relations. So he gives a justification. He tries to justify his inaction. And so it begins, you know, 28th verse of the first chapter, you know, you find Dushtvevam sujanam krishna yutsum samuvastidam sidanti mamagatrani bhugam chavari sushyadi veba dushya sarire me roma harsasya jayade gandivam samsade hastaktu chiva paridakhi. This is the 28th verse of the first chapter. Please don't mind. I will quote the Sanskrit verses. But even if you don't care for the Sanskrit verses, you are not going to lose anything. I shall explain in English. I shall give interpretation, long interpretations in English. So what Lord Krishna found was this. his student standing in front of him, telling him that he is not willing to do his duty. So, and this Arjuna at the end of the text, 18th chapter, tells Krishna, well, I shall do my duty according to your instruction. Many thinkers, many interpreters like Gandhi, Aravindo and others have interpreted Gita in the context of our natural psychological or human struggles in our mind, struggles of our of the human mind to cope with ideas, problems. So it is a metaphor, it is a figurative, it is an illustration of a kind of inner warfare that frequently goes on in our mind as to what we must do and what we have to do, how we must do and how we must not do. This is the interpretation of men like Gandhiji or Aravindo, Gandhiji's student and a much greater scholar, Vinoba Bhave and others. So this is how they have interpreted. So you find here a gradual evolution of Arjuna's mind, where the beginning of the text, in the first chapter, the student faces a lot of problems and he is in a state of total confusion, total ignorance, inner conflict. And that student, Arjuna, to the end of the 18th chapter, tells Krishna, well, I am now free from all doubts and conflicts. So what are the stages of evolution, the different stages of evolution of Arjuna's mind? That I shall briefly try to explain to you. Lord Krishna never teaches karma yoga to Arjuna at the beginning. A person who is not willing to do his basic duties and responsibilities, you can't teach philosophy to him. A person, let's say a teacher who is not doing his job as a teacher, a student who is not doing his best to study, or a doctor who is not doing a good job of treating patients, that person should first of all be taught to do his duty properly. You cannot and you should not teach higher transcendental philosophy to him, because he may use that philosophy for justifying his lack of a sense of duty. And he may try to justify his inaction. It involves a kind of hypocrisy. This is a very interesting statement. I can give an example in Gita itself. I shall quote these verses, that's the way we are expected to explain. Karmendriyani samyamya yasthe manasa smaran indriyatha vimudharma mithyacharaha sauchyate. Our Krishna is using a strong language here. Mithyachara means you are a hypocrite. Not a very pleasant word to listen, to hear. You know why Krishna tells Arjuna, a person who has a lot of ambitions and desires and is not willing to do his work, his duty, to fulfill those ambitions, trying to take refuge in higher philosophy as a pretext for not doing his duty, is a hypocrite. That is an interesting thing. So, a person who has a duty to perform and who has a lot of desires that he wants to fulfill, but out of laziness or inertia wants to conceal his real problem by giving a false justification to justify, to philosophize his inaction, is a hypocrite. This is Lord Krishna's statement. So the first instruction to Arjuna, the disciple, is do your work. Whatever may be that work. So, first, we must evolve a sense of duty consciousness, giving up inertia, lethargy, and in the subtle way our mind plays a trick. Frequently, there are things that we want to do, but there are things that our mind is willing to allow us to do. our mind doesn't always allow us to do what we want to do. It's a conflict between intellect and mind. Our emotions and feelings and natural tendencies and characteristics may not allow us to do what we want to do. Suppose tomorrow, well, reading the Gita, you have a strong desire to do meditation or to start reading scriptures, take a decision. Tomorrow morning, and you take it tomorrow, 7 o'clock morning, I shall read. So when you bring the book and you try to read immediately, sometimes, you know, we will be looking for a way out of this predicament. So newspaper, today I have an appointment, I shall start reading scripture tomorrow. Postponement. So actually mind is trying to create a mental block when we actually want to do, or when we are trying to do what we have decided to do, what we want to do. That's because of the conflict between mind and intellect. So in order to avoid this problem, Lord Krishna says, he tells Arjuna, don't think about your philosophy. In fact, Arjuna gave a lot of philosophical justifications for running away from his duty, running away from his responsibilities. So Lord Krishna says, no, you can never succeed by running away from your duties and responsibilities. Work may create problems, but the solution for those problems is through work and not by running away from work. So you must evolve a new perspective towards work. So Krishna first tells Arjuna, you must do your duty. And not only that, if you run away from your duties and responsibilities, you will be belittled, you will be slighted, you will be discredited by your friends and also by all people. So the first instruction is, do your duty. If you cannot do your duty with the higher spiritual perspective, then do your duty any way you can, you want. But doing our duty is the first responsibility. But duty itself, efficiency itself may not be enough to give us a happy life. I referred to this earlier. The most successful people, the most efficient people are not the happiest. Some of the most efficient people, some of the happiest people are also the most depressed. So happiness there is lopsided. Happiness only from an external perspective. They are not happy within themselves. They have achieved certain things. Thus that happiness is only an interpretation from outside by others. In their own inner mind, in their own private world, they are unhappy. So unless you are happy in your own inner private chamber, in your own inner mind, happiness cannot be called happiness. So how to attain happiness? Within our own inner mind, this inner contentment. And of course, happiness from our external perspective. Efficiency, success and all that. How to do that? For that, we must combine efficiency and higher spiritual ideal. So action and contemplation. Action should be the efficiency, success, all these. Action should be there. But action alone will not do. As I mentioned, the most active people are not always the happiest. So action should be combined with contemplation. Contemplation helps us to set a new sense of priorities. So, action and contemplation. In the second chapter, Lord Krishna gives an interesting definition to this process of combining action and contemplation. He says, Yogastha Guru Karmani Sangam Tektva Dhananjaya Siddhya Siddhyo Samabhuta Samattam Yoga Uchyate Buddhi Yukto Jahadiha Ube Sugraduskude Tasma Yoga Yujasa Yoga Karmasu Kausalam. Please don't mind, this is only beginning. we are going to discuss these verses very elaborately in course of time. I am now just giving just a kind of introduction to Gita, especially to the most relevant message of Gita for our times. That's what I am trying to do today. We have not entered the text so far. We will enter the text with the next class. So, what Lord Krishna says is this. Do your duty. Prayogastha. Yogastha means being established in yoga. Yoga means linking ourselves to this higher perspective, to higher transcendental ideal. We must do our work. Then what happens, you know, Siddhya Siddhu Samabhuta. Literal translation may not be always enough. But it means, don't worry about the result of your actions. It doesn't mean indifference or negligence or a kind of inefficient attitude towards work. What it means is, do your best and don't worry about it. Normally, it is not work that creates problems. It is our concern, our worry about the results of what we are doing that actually creates problems. Work doesn't create problems. Normally. Of course, there are kinds of work which really create problems at the time of doing work. But from a psychological perspective, when we do certain work, our normal duties, let us see, that we normally perform, if we do that work with a lot of anxiety, lot of worry about the results, what is going to happen, whether the results would be up to the expectation or not, disconcerned, that anxiety will distract the mind, and that actually creates a dissipation of our psychological energy, physical energy. So we won't be able to fully concentrate on what we are doing if our mind is distracted towards various kinds of possible speculations, anxieties and worries, tensions related to or thoughts about the result. So that part, don't worry, do your best. If we can work like that, then we'll be able to do our work with greater concentration and greater focus, and work will be more efficient, successful. And if the result is not up to the expectation, we won't be shocked. We won't be devastated. It will not create disappointment. Normally, work done with full concentration will invariably produce expected result. And if we can do work without worrying so much, without being obsessed, this obsession is a very important thing, you know. Obsession makes you a slave of your own mind and thought processes. Obsession incapacitates it. It brings in a kind of inner psychological slavery. So, if we can do our work without being obsessed with the result, then work can be efficient and effective. And if the results are not up to the expectation, it will not create any disappointment. This is one of the marvelous messages. Actually, many of these ideas are used in modern management ideas without, of course, referring to Gita or anything, you know, but you often done it. So this is one important message of Bhagavad Gita. It's karma yoga. It helps us to succeed in our life, whatever may be our profession. But at the same time, it also helps us to avoid some of the problems which are inevitable when people succeed. And those problems will take away the charm, the real benefit of success. So Lord Krishna is putting before us a very comprehensive philosophy that can be used even in modern times, in our everyday life, in everyday life situations. Now we have 10 minutes. So you are most welcome to interact with me. You can ask questions on any of the related subjects. You are most welcome. We have 10 minutes or more than 10 minutes.
Then again, there can be, then there can be failure. What is the attitude towards failure?
Yeah. Now, if we do our work with a degree of detachment, detachment never means negligence or indifference. Mentally, you know, what detachment actually happens in our life? When we work very hard with full concentration, but still when we remember in our mind that I may succeed, but still that success in that material life will not give me absolute, complete, everlasting happiness. So this awareness gives you a kind of contentment. It helps you when you do not succeed, there is a failure. This awareness will not shock you. It may have some difficulties, but it will not be a devastating problem for you. So, in fact, that keeps the mind in a state of equilibrium. That's what happens. So, really, we all know, everyone knows. See, every educated person, even uneducated people also know that all these worldly enjoyments will not be there after some years. After all, you won't be there. So what about worldly enjoyments? If you live happy 100 years, you may live, no doubt. That's true. So everyone knows this. But we often forget this. It doesn't mean that we should be pessimistic. Not at all. It's a very serious problem. In fact, one of the most serious misunderstandings about this Vedanta or the teaching of Gita is, it's a life-negating, world-negating philosophy. Not at all. It gives you a total and complete view of life as a whole, so that you are equipped with a mechanism to deal with a possible absence of success, with a possible failure. After all, no one can guarantee 100% continuous success. I don't think anyone in this world can claim, I have always succeeded in everything. No. It never happens. Success and failure. If there is success, there can be some failure. It's like a coin with two sides. You can't have a coin with only one side. So this fact, which all of us know, is brought to our attention by the teacher of Bhagavad Gita. We forget this because we want to forget this. Really. We don't want to remember the reality of life. So Lord Krishna is trying to bring to our attention a fact that we all know. That we do not always succeed. We do not always succeed in everything that we try to do. Never happens. It's impossible. But very often, we don't want to remember that. So, when you don't remember, you have to pay a price for this. What's the price? Becoming too anxious, becoming too worried, when you do not always succeed. So, that's the thing. So, Lord Krishna wants to bring this to our attention.
Yeah. In the Bhagavad Gita, it talks a lot about, you talk about the importance of duty. What if you have a job that's immoral?
Duty. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking of the classic.
You're falling?
I'm talking about Connor Wrench. He wrote about Eichmann in Jerusalem with the banality
Oh, yeah.
He says, you know, I was just following orders.
Yes, you're talking about those events, yeah. Those events. People who understand the teachings of Gita will always be able to keep out of those things. Even those who reach these higher ideals will develop a kind of inner mechanism, an inner consciousness that helps them to automatically keep out of these dilemmas. The Vedanta, in course of time, you will understand Vedanta is a very universal humanistic philosophy, ethical philosophy. It tells you that God, the divine, is present in everyone, in everything. You cannot physically or mentally do harm to anything in the world or anyone in the world, because when you hurt somebody, you are hurting yourself. So those who study Vedanta will automatically keep out of actions and events that are harmful to everyone. No. Now, what is duty? I tell you, so duty becomes an extremely immoral concept if you put it that way. So every evil person can say that it is his duty to do that. That will be a very, very, very perverted argument. That's true. So that's not what Lord Krishna is speaking about. So the, you know, behind this karma yoga ideal, there is a higher metaphysical principle. That metaphysical principle is to look upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family. To look upon the whole humanity, the whole creation as one spiritual family. You cannot hurt anyone. You cannot mentally or physically do harm to anyone when you read this, when you learn this higher metaphysical ideal of Vedanta. So karma yoga itself is totally different from Kantian concept of duty, where duty as a very secular, a very non-spiritual, a very physical interpretation. Truly. But here, duty has got a spiritual element. In course of time, as we enter the text, you will understand every performance of duty with a sense of sacredness and sanctity will bring in, will unfold the inner spiritual divine reality within you. And you will be able to understand the presence of the divine everywhere. So that is a metaphysical idea. A person who practices unselfishness cannot be evil. In fact, one important aspect of anyone who practices karma yoga is you be unselfish. All evil is built upon the idea of selfishness. All immorality is built upon selfishness. This is an important point to remember. All immorality, all evil things have the foundation. The foundation is selfishness, self-interest, self-aggrandizement. So when a person performs duty without any obsessive attachment to anything, then he becomes more and more unselfish. You find, surprisingly you find, people who have practiced total freedom from selfishness have become spiritually so great, even without the aid of any organized religion or a god. So, that's a very important point to remember. Gita takes you to a higher concept of God as the one divine reality present everywhere and in everything. So that when you hurt a person, you're hurting yourself. You cannot do harm to anyone without eventually doing harm to yourself.
So could you say that personal consciousness is more important than social duty?
I tell you, when any individual, develops this inner unselfishness, total freedom from unselfishness, then it will have an effect on society. You see, if you look at the history of the spiritual evolution, the ethical evolution of humanity, after all, this evolution happened thanks to a few great individuals who could influence large numbers of people. So very often we become concerned with society that becomes a pretext for not trying to evolve ourselves. When we evolve, our perspective will be different. Individualism is not selfishness if it is linked to a spiritual ideal. Individualism can become selfishness when it is linked to a secular ideal. But I want to pray, I want to meditate, I want to read the Holy Scriptures, I want to do something good for others. Somebody, you are so selfish that you want to spiritually progress. You are so selfish that you want to be unselfish. Working for unselfishness, working for purity becomes a selfish act. Arguments can be so perverted. No, actually you find all the great men and great women the world produced became perfect in their own inner life. So that perfection eventually influenced others. And that influence continues. Whether you take Jesus, Buddha, or Shankaracharya, Ramakrishna, anyone, take any great spiritual persons. We find in their life there is an ascent in the direction of their own inner spiritual unfoldment. And afterwards, they start preaching to others. So this is a very important point, remember. When we try to evolve our own spiritual life by practicing unselfishness, by practicing spiritual values, you are making a great contribution to society, really. Really, no? If we can pray, if we can lead a spiritual life, that effort is a great contribution to society. Think of man like Emerson, Thoreau, with just a handful of individuals in this country. You still remember? People read their books. People are inspired by their thoughts. Emerson's Brahma begins with almost an English verbatim translation of the 19th verse of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Ye enam vetti handaram vishchayanam mannidehadam ubhautau navijanito nayam hanti nahanyade. The Emerson says there is one absolute reality. That's our true nature. It is eternal. It is immortal. It doesn't die. It cannot be killed. And it cannot kill anyone. In the sense, it is immortal. It is imperishable. Now, you remember, maybe his friends must have told you, you are going and contemplating, reading higher books, it is for your selfishness. No, but that selfishness helps so many people to become unselfish. Buddha, let us say, take Buddha. Buddha was born as a prince and he had four visions. He saw a dead body taken to cremation ground. He saw an old man and a sick man. Three unpleasant visions of realities of human life. And then he saw a saint, serene, calm and quiet, absolutely serene and content. He wanted to be like that saint. And that night, he left his palace and walked 1200 miles, reached Bodhgaya, sat in meditation. One can say, he was so selfish, he was working for his spiritual enlightenment. Because he worked for his own spiritual enlightenment, millions of people were benefited by that. You see? So, that's a very important thing. All these great men who go deeper into their own inner life and unfold the spiritual dimension of their own personality, eventually they are making a great contribution to human civilization, human society. So this is a very important thing to remember. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. We'll continue next Friday. Most welcome. And I'm very happy that we could start eventually start this class on this very historical building. And it's a very historical building. The first Hindu temple outside Asian continent, outside India and Asian continent. So, thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.